I'm Amelia Mola Schmidt, and you're listening to In Conversation with Radio Laurier. When we think of the Canadian landscape, we often think of abundance. A land that is vast and home to many natural resources, full of space that, according to the 2016 Census of Agriculture, hosts 193,492 farms. Although our farm space is abundant, well over 4 million people in Canada are currently experiencing food insecurity. This week on our podcast, we talk to Victoria Foote, Director of Development and Communications at FoodShare Toronto. FoodShare is a food justice organization that has been around for over 35 years. FoodShare strives for food justice by collaborating with and listening to those most affected by poverty and food insecurity, Black, Indigenous, people of color, and people with disabilities, to inspire long-term solutions to an equitable and nutritious food system for everyone. Hi, Victoria. Thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast. So please go right ahead and introduce yourself. And can you tell us a bit about your role at FoodShare?
Yes. Well, listen, thank you for having me, Amelia. I'm the Director of Development and Communications at FoodShare. I started not too long ago in September 2019. FoodShare is a wonderful food justice organization. I'm privileged and honored to work there. The organization has between 50 and 60 employees, full and part-time, all in. They run such a range of programs from student nutrition to urban agricultural projects to good food markets and community kitchens and so much more. The reach is really extraordinary. In fact, FoodShare reaches more than 260,000 people a year through all its initiatives. So again, it's a big organization with a big reach that's really making a difference for the kind of city we live in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And such an urban city that keeps getting urban, I'm not even using a correct word here, but urbaner and urbaner. My professors might hear this and think, I taught her?
Like that word, though. It works. It completely works. Well, you know, I mean, as we've discovered, perhaps somewhat painfully through the pandemic, it is a high-density city. Mm-hmm. And we are a constant influx of folks, whether it's from other parts of the country or other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So it is a rapidly growing city, having already established itself as the largest one in the country. So I understand your use of the word urbaner.
Thank you. Someone finally gets me. No. Now, just before we get into some more detailed questions, I just want to, for our listeners' sake, understand the concept of food security. So can you give us an outline of what this term means, what it means to be food secure?
So food secure, and again, what we do is we address food insecurity. Mm-hmm. But food secure means that you are in a position where you consistently mm-hmm. and reliably have access to good, fresh, nutritious, mm-hmm. culturally appropriate food. Right. And this is something that you never really need to worry about. Mm-hmm. If that's your situation, and I am a fortunate person in that that is my situation, I am food secure. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, despite living in a wealthy country of plenty, and despite the fact that Canada, whether it's Toronto or, you know, from coast to coast, mm-hmm. Does not suffer any scarcity in food or agricultural resources, nevertheless, well over 4 million people in Canada are food insecure. Mm-hmm. And that was pre-pandemic, approximately 4.4 million people. So that's, you know, another way to look at it is, Canada-wide, it's approximately one in seven households wow. would be designated food insecure. They cannot consistently say that they have access to good, fresh food.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about food insecurity, of course, and this is what FoodShare is fighting against. What are some of the reasons behind people facing food insecurity? Because as you said, we live in a country, we have such an abundance of land. So what are the main causes behind people facing food insecurity?
So the root cause of food insecurity is poverty. Mm-hmm. It's cost. Mm-hmm. Again, there's plenty of food to go around. So the barrier, it's expensive. People can't afford it. People who live in low-income communities, they suffer. They are challenged with job precarity, mm-hmm. Employment uncertainty. And what informs, equally importantly, what informs poverty are what we've seen as systemic and entrenched forms of structural oppression. Mm-hmm. A recent research project that FoodShare undertook with Proof Research Group based at the University of Toronto mm-hmm. demonstrated through data collection and very rigorous means that racialized, specifically Black communities or Black households, I should say, are challenged with food insecurity at much higher levels than white households. Mm-hmm. So anti-Black racism and other forms of structural oppression mm-hmm. Feed into the whole situation where people are locked into a system of poverty. Mm-hmm. And as such, they don't have access to good food. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which leads into a whole other skew of issues, I'm sure, because nourishment is step one in fueling your day, fueling your ability to go out and work or learn for children.
Oh, you're so right about that. So it absolutely affects, you know, health outcomes, mm-hmm. mental well-being, yeah. Being able to access just basic amenities, mm-hmm. how you get through the day. The list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. There's no end of consequences to living under such precarious conditions. And the pandemic has exacerbated all this, mm-hmm. and it's also surfaced these issues. And again, this is why FoodShare defines itself as a food justice organization. Mm-hmm. And while we absolutely recognize the need for food banks, we are at the same time very aware that it is a so-called Band-Aid solution. Mm-hmm. It is a short-term solution at mm-hmm. best. There are definitely weaknesses, not through the fault of food banks, but, through the fault of our systems. There are weaknesses in the approach where we defer to sort of charitable handouts
yeah.
to solve the problem of hunger, which is, again, this is the problem of hunger is really the problem of poverty. As Paul Taylor, our executive director, has said, poverty has been redefined as hunger mm-hmm. and outsourced in a sense by the state to charities to fix.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Charities can't begin to fix this. The first food bank opened in the early 1980s, and the use of food banks has climbed steadily ever since. Mm-hmm. So that alone demonstrates that this is not the solution.
Mm-hmm. No,
that it's not. Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you. I even think about organizations where corporations and restaurants are donating leftovers. And it's exactly what you mentioned earlier. It's a Band-Aid solution, and it doesn't look at the systemic, the policies behind poverty and oppression, all the systemic barriers that families are facing and people are facing that lead to food insecurity.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you should not be, no one should be in a situation where they're denied what's recognized by the UN as a basic human and fundamental right, which mm-hmm. is access, again, to good, nutritious, culturally appropriate food. Mm-hmm. Everyone should be able to feed themselves, their families, their communities, in dignity and on their own terms.
Yes.
It's a fundamental human right. Mm-hmm. And when people cannot, especially when you have millions of people in a country like Canada who cannot realize that right, mm-hmm. then, something has gone wrong mm-hmm. deep within the system.
And you said that's 4.4 million pre-pandemic.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, I just want to talk about pre-pandemic again here. What were the greatest challenges that your organization was facing, let's say, before the pandemic hit?
Before the pandemic hit, I mean, in some ways, they were the same challenges we're facing now, just at a much less degree, if you will. Mm-hmm. Definitely, you know, pre-pandemic, we were always pushing for better policies. We were always advocating mm-hmm. for, you know, basic incomes, higher minimum wage, you mm-hmm. know, working with 15 and fair. Yeah. Sorry.
No
worries. So we'll pause there. Understanding the role of mm-hmm. Of having, you know, a livable wage mm-hmm. in order to access good food.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But really, when the pandemic hit, we had to shut down all those programs, yeah. or at least put them on pause to a great extent. Mm-hmm. All these critically needed programs, like the student nutrition program,
mm-hmm.
or our good food markets,
mm-hmm.
and many others, we had to put them, best case scenario, on pause because of the pandemic. So that really dramatically changed what people could have access to. So all those, you know, students, for example, who benefited from our student nutrition program
mm-hmm.
in, you know, nearly 1,000 schools across the GTA, were now returning to households that were already food insecure.
Mm-hmm.
So really, our challenges were just trying to meet the need of better access to good food
mm-hmm.
from a number of fronts pre-pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But once the pandemic and lockdown hit, we had to do some very abrupt pivots in whether we could deliver a program at all, mm-hmm. if so, how we would deliver it.
Mm-hmm.
And then simultaneously, at the same time, we took what we call our social enterprise through our program, our so-called Good Food Box program,
mm-hmm.
where people can purchase either on a subscription regular basis or as a one-off boxes that are delivered to your doorstep of fresh produce.
Right.
And they come in different kinds. You can get a small one, a large one, organic one, and, you know, different kinds of wellness box and so on. You choose the one you want. You purchase it. The revenue goes towards supporting our other programs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the pandemic hit, we took that existing initiative, the Good Food right. Box, and we did this abrupt pivot where we redesignated boxes as emergency good yeah. food boxes.
Yeah, we've reading about this on your website. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this was to meet the needs of folks that we were beginning with communities that we were already serving, that yeah. we already knew were food insecure,
mm-hmm.
trying to meet their needs, but now we're trying to meet them in a much more urgent
mm-hmm.
and somewhat different way. So by emergency, we're saying these are free food boxes.
Wow.
Everyone got what we call a large food box,
mm-hmm.
and a large food box has enough fresh produce in it to feed a family of four for approximately 1 week.
Wow, that's impressive.
So, and when we use the produce from that's grown organically on our urban agricultural projects
mm-hmm.
and our
mm-hmm.
urban farms, many of which are located in neighborhood improvement areas.
Mm-hmm.
So we really try to give, manage to put into each box only the highest quality, so-called grade A produce, fruits and veggies.
Right.
So we started off in week one. This began the middle of March, mm-hmm. like around March 17th, once the lockdown, you know, was
yeah.
placed. And the latest figures I've seen, which take us probably to end of last week or pretty close to,
mm-hmm.
We had to date since mid-March delivered almost 40,000 food boxes.
Wow.
And we are working with approximately 80 or more
mm-hmm.
frontline local agencies.
Wow.
That in turn know the needs of the communities they serve. You know, it's places like Black Creek Community Farm that serves the Jane Finch area,
yeah.
or the Greenest City in the Parkdale neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
or Maggie's Toronto Sex Workers Action Project,
mm-hmm.
And many others. They're all listed on our website.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working with more and more just so quickly, week after week, more and more
mm-hmm.
groups were coming to us. You know, the justice for migrant workers, agricultural seasonal workers. The list goes on and on of us collaborating just in a quick turnaround period closely with local grassroots organizations that really had their ear to the ground, knew the needs of the people they worked with and were serving, and knew how many boxes they could that were required and for how long. When Foodora suddenly shut its doors, and all those couriers were suddenly from one day to the next out of work, we delivered 500 food boxes. It would have been more. There were approximately 500 couriers in the city who suddenly were unemployed. And we delivered food boxes for 2 or 3 weeks to each one of them.
Wow.
So it just snowballed. But it also demonstrated how vulnerable, how much of the population just of the GTA is when something like this hits. So I think for a lot of people, that was a real eye opener. And then, you know, it started to also, you know, as you were sort of referencing earlier in our conversation, it also surfaced, the pandemic's also surfaced, not just food insecurity, although that was first and foremost, but just also how precarious one's existence is. Why was it that in certain clusters of the city, like in the north western part, the Jane Finch area, for example, there was so much higher rates of people infected with the virus than in other parts of the city? You know, you look at the Beaches or Rosedale, extremely low rates of infection. People there can work from home. People have easy access to good health care. There's no shortage of reasons in predominantly white, upper middle class, upper class neighborhoods. Compared to those who can only make a living if they go to work, who have to take public transit to get to work, who cannot afford to stockpile groceries, who don't have the luxury of working at home, who live in crowded conditions with substandard housing, on and on. So suddenly you could see that food security did not exist in isolation. It was attached to all sorts of inequities in our society. And then you needed to root around and say, well, why are there these inequities? What's informing them? And then you get, you know, to the bedrock of the legacy of colonialism and white supremacy and anti-Black racism and again, structural oppression against, you know, BIPOC folks, Indigenous folks, people with disabilities. We're also serving socially isolated seniors, people with mental health challenges. So it really, the pandemic, I think, really, again, surfaced all these underlying currents that some of us could see, but many could not. But now I think you can't unsee it.
No, that's something exactly I was thinking about as you were talking, Victoria, that these inequalities have always existed, but some who are privileged enough to not get to see it on, you know, because they're not working with organizations like Food Share, or they haven't had to be in these positions, these precarious positions, but it's been absolutely blown out of the water by the pandemic and by the fact that, like you said, many racialized neighborhoods in the city have been impacted way at a much higher rate with cases of infection, exactly because of what you said, crowded living conditions and public transit. So it's amazing. And even what you were saying with Foodora and all your emergency response boxes for fresh food for all families, this is amazing work. And it just shows how resilient our community can be. And it's almost like, imagine what could be happening if you had policy in place that supported organizations like Food Share and advocated.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So we do need, you know, we do need to address the sort of structural barriers to accessing good food. And it does run deep and wide. And, you know, it's, and part of that process will have to be making space at the decision-making level.
Yes.
For the folks who are most affected by these issues, for them to have a role, a meaningful role in making policy decisions and have in being part of the conversation
Absolutely.
About how we can dismantle oppression and how we can make it things better.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to pivot to something a little happier. I read that FoodShare has a program called the Community Food Growing Program. And this summer, 6 youth were hired and learned how to farm in an urban area in Etobicoke. So can you tell me a bit about this program? I think this is fantastic because it's teaching the next, you know, younger generation how to sustainably grow food in, you know, again, the city of Toronto, even though Etobicoke is a little on the outskirts, but this is fantastic.
Yeah, you're right. This is just a terrific program. This is in a 2.5-3 acre piece of land that was not being used. And FoodShare had worked hard with other partners in the city of Toronto to be able to turn it into an urban farm. And they were successfully able to do that after a few years of working together. And I believe at first, you know, crops were first planted, if I understand correctly, it slightly predates when I came on board, but I think it was the spring of 2019, so wow. Pretty recently. And it's attached to Burnham Thorpe Collegiate Institute, which is a large high school. And I think it's in a neighborhood improvement area, but I would need to check myself on that one. Anyways, it's just a fantastic organic farm that FoodShare staff support, and it's got a very large composting operation on it as well. That's just terrific. And I know last year when things, you know, pre-pandemic, part of the undertaking was a weekly food market. I believe it was on Thursdays for a couple hours every Thursday. And, you know, everyone in the neighborhood could go to this market and buy the fruits and veggies, or mostly veggies, I guess, that were grown on the market or on the grounds at very affordable prices. Oh, and it was just gorgeous. You know, it was all the tomatoes and the peppers and the kale and the lettuces and the okra and the beans. And it goes on and on. Yeah. Basil, herbs, all sorts of herbs. I can't even begin to list all the things they grew, eggplants on this gorgeous place, the biggest beets I have ever seen. And they were just beautiful, beautiful. And the other thing that this market did, which I thought was so interesting, is that a lot of people in the nearby area live in some of the tower apartment buildings, and you can't compost within your apartment. So what we did is we encouraged people, to just bring their kitchen scraps when they came to the market in a pail. We could use it. So we would take their scraps, add it to our big compost pile to be, of course, dumped back onto the soil for some nice, rich, nutritious soil. And in return, if you you would get, the person bringing their kitchen scraps would get a voucher. They could use that voucher to get an even greater discount on any produce they wanted to buy. Wow. So it's a lovely kind of, it was its own kind of social ecosystem.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
It was just a beautiful thing. So boy, and it was student run. The market was student run. And sometimes they, you know, one of the students would be act as a kind of DJ and they'd have some music going and a lot of fun with it. And we would sell out.
That's amazing.
That was gone. That was it became a real hub. So I think we're kind of missing the market this summer, but the yield is just something fantastic. We're talking about tens of thousands of pounds of fresh, beautiful, beautiful produce.
Wow.
And yes, we always hire some students to help out. We pay just above minimum wage. We do believe in a livable wage. It's not just sort of talk. We kind of walk the talk. And they learn a great deal. They learn all about farming. They have, you know, real life skills. They learn about the composting. Usually a student will have something that he or she sort of prefers to do.
Yeah.
And that's all the better. So they can really follow their interests. There's leadership skills. They can get references from as well as a result. So all kinds of learning is involved. And it's just a great opportunity to be outside and to farm and to see the incredible results of all your hard work.
Well, it must be so fulfilling, right? Seeing that harvest at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's fulfilling even when you don't work on the land. Yeah. It's just a remarkable thing to visit.
And even like kids who grew up in Toronto, like in the core, may not have the access to a garden in the backyard where they could have experimented in planting and growing with their parents or guardians. So I think it's amazing that our food share is giving opportunities like this. I was even reflecting on, like, just in my neighborhood in the city, I'm from the East End, just more community gardens popping up where just the community comes together and plants some things, and it's kind of take what you need. If you can plant something, that's great. But I think that's fantastic, again, just because not everybody has the opportunity to try gardening. So when it's in a communal space, there's so much more that goes along with that experience, right? Growing together.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I do think that over and above being sort of a wonderful initiative all by itself, I think the other thing the pandemic is sort of really exposing is the importance of having sort of urban agriculture as becoming more the norm in terms of food security and food sovereignty and control over the food system. So I think a lot of people have had to reassess and reevaluate and rethink how they access good food and what's possible. You can grow a fair bit of food in a surprisingly small amount of space. It doesn't have to be an abandoned, you know, 3-acre plot of land either.
No, not at all.
Right? Exactly. And one of our partner organizations, again, Black Creek Community Farm, I mean, there's so many, you know, I'm hesitant to single one out, but that's, I believe, an 8-acre farm around the Jane Finch area. And the amount of produce produced there is extraordinary. So it does demonstrate what we can do and perhaps what we should be doing, not just for a food justice and social justice reasons, although those are first and foremost. Who has control over the food system from start to finish? Are we relying on, you know, oppressed and underpaid seasonal labor? Or are we doing it in a fair way, in an equitable way, in a local way? Not to mention how this supports environmental concerns and the fact that urban centers are the biggest contributors to the climate crisis between transportation and infrastructure and buildings and so on. Urban areas are the emitters of the, you know, highest levels of greenhouse gas emissions. Agriculture has a huge role in that. So again, this does seem to be a solution that just needs to really be tapped into much more for a number of really compelling reasons.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. Now, I just want to pivot a little bit again and talk about policy. Canada is the only G7 country without a cost-shared national school food program. Back in March, Doug Ford, Premier of Ontario, rejected a breakfast programs at school, deeming it that if parents are sending their children to school hungry, then they aren't fulfilling their responsibilities. Now, when politicians like this are in power who are blatantly ignoring the systemic and historically oppressive reasons people aren't able to feed their children, what does that, how does that affect organizations like FoodShare? Because it must put an immense amount of like responsibility on organizations like yours?
Well, yes. I mean, I would say, you know, this would be a very stark example of a government, in this instance, provincial, but I can't let off other levels of government, let other levels of government off the hook. But certainly this is a more sort of stark example or instance instance of offloading a government responsibility onto the backs of the nonprofit sector, mm-hmm. and to basically paint predominantly racialized communities and certainly low-income communities in an insulting and denigrating light, mm-hmm. as if these are irresponsible parents, when of course nothing could be, you know, there's no basis whatsoever for saying something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's sort of the kindest way I could put it. Yeah. I mean, you know, that is just a complete abdication of responsibility that is layered on with, you know, discriminatory language.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, one final question before we wrap up here, but if there have been any positive outcomes from the pandemic when it comes to the awareness or the public's knowledge of the importance of food security, do you think anything like that will come about? Are you feeling that there will be affirmative action, affirmative change, because the pandemic has really laid bare the unfortunate yeah. truths that many Canadians face and Torontonians?
So this is, you know, this is the question, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And as you and I were saying earlier, you know, you can't unsee it now. You can't unsee what you've seen. So I'm sort of personally, and I just have to speak personally on this, you know, I really cling to that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no question we've seen movements in the right direction. Mm-hmm. The Black Lives Matter movement and all the organizations, Not Another Black Life, I mean, there's so many. Mm-hmm. Organizations that have been doing extraordinary work mm-hmm. under the most troubling and difficult circumstances. I think there's incredible momentum now. Mm-hmm. I think issues that were buried for many of us have been unearthed, so to speak. I hope that's not just too torturous a metaphor. And I do like to think that more than lip service will be paid. I do like to think that we will see true change. And I cannot, you know, we can't exempt the nonprofit sector and those of us working in the food world mm-hmm. from that. Mm-hmm. Definitely, if you look around at nonprofits in general, and certainly those working, you know, in the sector that we do, most, not all, but the majority of folks at the decision-making level, at the leadership levels, are white, middle-class, straight, mm-hmm. Very, you know, not, you know, we're all in decision-making positions, mm-hmm. and that will need to change. Mm-hmm. So it's all sectors of how our society runs mm-hmm. that need to change. And I do like to think that that will happen. And time will tell, but I think if there was ever a time to really feel, like just feel in yourself the momentum for that kind of change, mm-hmm. even though it's large and messy and hard, I think now is the time.
Mm-hmm. No. Those are some hopeful words to end off on. And I'm hopeful of the same thing, Victoria. So I just want to say thank you so much for joining us and telling mm-hmm. us more about the amazing work that FoodShare does. Thank you so much for your time.
And yeah, well, thank you for asking us and for reaching out. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely. Wishing you all the best.
Thank you.
To learn more about the incredible work that FoodShare does, visit www.foodshare.net. In Conversation with Radio Laurier is written and produced by Amelia Mola-Schmidt. The song we use is called Loopster by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.